I next met with Dr. Chris Logothetis. To begin, he commented on alpha radon.
Let me try to frame the new alpha emitters in the context of the past history that we have with the use of radiopharmaceuticals in prostate cancer. So first of all, prostate cancer is almost the poster child of a unique disease that has a very restricted behavior, and it's dominated by these bone metastases to the point that many of us believe that prostate cancer mimics bone in its progression. That accounts for why it migrates to bone, why it preferentially goes to bone, and why molecular pathways implicated in the progression and the development of bone also drive prostate cancer progression. So by way of background, it puts bone in its center. And many years ago, Dr. Tu at our institution was trying to ask the following question. Can you inhibit the disease to a point, once it's even migrated to bone, to alter the course enough that you can impact survival? Now, that's critical because as oncologists, we typically think of the disease as being localized or systemic. And here, what basically we're trying to promote is a concept that there's something in between. And that is that the cancer migrates to a specific organ site. And even though it's no longer localized, you have to account for the anatomy and the outcome. And in that paper, using the first relatively blunt instrument, radiopharmaceutical, we use strontium-89, which is a radiopharmaceutical that mimics calcium on the periodic table, goes to bone, and emits a beta emitter. And that showed that there was a favorable impact on survival in a small trial that was randomized, and in previous and subsequent trials resulted in palliation of metastases. That changed everything for us and many investigators because it suggested that if we target bone, we could really alter the course of the illness. The recent most active radiopharmaceuticals are now alpha emitters, which means that they can even penetrate less and provide effective radiotherapy exclusively to bone and cause a less myelosuppression. So the therapeutic index of these bone-homing radiopharmaceuticals has greatly been enhanced. And there's a suggestion in a press release that this agent, again, the manuscript is not open for detailed review, prolongs survival.
Now, what exactly is it? What's the actual agent that's tagged?
So it's an alpha emitter, okay? And it's a derivative of iodine, basically, is what these things are. And they release the radiopharmaceutical directly in bone and exclusively in bone. But the most important point to note is that it's an alpha emitter. So the degree of penetrance is very, very small. It doesn't radiate people around them, and it doesn't cause myelosuppression.
So just out of naivete, when I hear, radioactive agent and iodine, I think thyroid more than prostate.
Yeah. So it does not migrate to thyroid because it's been modified. It exclusively goes to bone, so it's really protected. But the critical element here is that it's an alpha emitter.
Interesting. And I guess maybe an associated issue is other bone-targeted treatment and progression. We've seen a lot of data with bisphosphonates and breast cancer that kind of right now doesn't seem all that straightforward. What about bone-targeted therapy and prostate cancer, particularly denosumab?
Yeah. So there's absolutely no question that agents which block osteoclasts, both bisphosphonates and denosumab, bisphosphonates in a more broad way by blocking the interaction of the osteoclast in bone, and denosumab in a very specific way by blocking the mediator called RANK ligand, impact the disease significantly in the sense that they relieve symptoms and delay time to progression, but they don't impact survival, which is a little bit of a surprise because if there was a disease that you would expect to impact survival, it would have been this disease that is so dominated by bone. And it speaks to the complexities of prostate cancer in bone because either we have not identified the subset of patients within the heterogeneous group that have bone metastases to target specifically, or It's, as we increasingly believe, a redundant network of pathways that actually adapt to intervention with one target. And that's the most likely thing, because if you think of this more like an endocrinologist would think of a disease rather than an oncologist who's driven by the desire to eradicate the disease, an endocrinologist would be driven by the desire to sort of control and modify the virulence of the disease. A disease with an adaptive response rather than clonal selection would lend itself better to a strategy of constantly adjusting to it and adapting to it rather than trying to eradicate it.
What new data has come out on denosumab that you think is most important for physicians to know about?
There were two studies performed. One was presented and published in The Lancet by Karim Fizazi for patients with established metastases that showed an effect relative to zoledronic acid of delaying time to symptomatic progression. And a more recent study that was presented in abstract form was presented but has not actually been available for detailed review yet, where the claim is that there's a delay in time to progression in the pre-metastatic setting, but they're not claiming a survival advantage.
And for practical purposes right now, for example, you know, let's start with the maybe least controversial, though maybe it's more controversial. How do you approach bone-targeted therapy in the patient with known disease to the bone?
So in patients with metastases and castration, as they're currently being treated, the use of bisphosphonates or denosumab are both approved and appropriate in order to delay the symptoms, but should not be expected to prolong survival.
What about choosing between the two?
Yeah. Difficult choice, because there are obviously cost issues here that are involved. There's obviously issues related to morbidity, some forms of morbidity. Osteonecrosis of the jaw seems to be similar in the two groups of patients, so that's not an indication to prefer one or the other. The use of denosumab is more convenient and less acutely morbid and doesn't have the kidney effect.
So what do you tend to do?
Well, you know, we've continued with the bisphosphonates with zoledronic acid without change, other than the select subset of patients who we feel there's a specific reason to avoid it. There are a subset that get lots of pain with zoledronic acid or who have compromised kidney function.
Agree or disagree, putting maybe the cost issues aside, the risk of a bone event is going to be less if you use denosumab or ZDA compared to ZDA?
The studies were designed to determine equivalence, not advantage. So, I mean, the numbers indicate a slight advantage for denosumab, but I think it's fair to say that there's a mathematical difference favoring denosumab. Whether that's paralleled by a clinically relevant difference is in question.
Now, bone-targeted therapy has also been looked at in patients about to receive androgen deprivation therapy, and I guess the most common time would be either upfront with locally advanced disease or in PSA progression. What about using it there in terms of trying to prevent osteoporosis and fractures?
Yeah. Compelling argument to both do two things, the dream that we have prevent metastases and then obviously prevent complications of androgen ablation. The latter is very straightforward. Most of us agree that the data suggests that once you have evidence of osteopenia, not osteoporosis, you can introduce the drug and delay the side effects. Using it up front in everybody who gets castrated over a protracted period of time has not been studied. Now, you can extrapolate reasonably from female osteoporosis data, once you have bone loss, introducing the drug early helps avoid it getting worse. So I think it's reasonable to monitor patients, and once there's evidence of bone loss, introduce a bisphosphonate or denosumab.
I was curious what you're saying about bone and prostate cancer from a translational biologic point of view. And there are at least a couple papers that I saw that you were involved with that I was curious about in terms of kind of better understanding some of the pathways that are being talked about now. One is from ASCO. It was a clinical science paper that you were a part of, MDV3100 and the effects on androgen receptor signaling and bone marrow testosterone concentration modulation, a preliminary report. Maybe you can talk about what you reported there, but also more globally how you conceptualize the milieu of prostate cancer, particularly as it relates to endocrine milieu.
So this is an area that's very exciting and fertile for research that's likely to translate into benefit for patients, and let me describe. We used to think of bone development pathways and androgen signaling as two different dimensions of this disease and two different ways of looking at it. We now know that androgen signaling is an essential part of maintaining a bone homeostasis, in retrospect, obvious. So this dichotomy between androgen signaling and bone is no longer a dichotomy, but there's a unifying concept here that bone development and functional pathways are implicated in prostate cancer progression. And we think that androgen signaling is the primary stromal epithelial interaction in bone.
Can you just draw that out a little bit more? Because when I hear androgen and bone, I think about, for some reason, postmenopausal osteoporosis.
Correct.
But I'm trying to remember the exact pathways.
So what happens is, under the influence of castration, the bone is challenged to maintain its homeostasis, and the cancer is challenged to survive. And what they both do is they develop methods of producing testosterone in the context of their own microenvironments. So CYP17 is one, altered androgen receptor pathways one, to either more efficiently use small amounts of testosterone that may persist or produce from cholesterol substrate testosterone in the microenvironment to replace that which has been deprived by castration.
Now, is that the pathway in bone also, or just prostate?
Correct. It's also in bone.
So you have the androgens hooking on to or stimulating what?
So androgen deprivation prompts a response in tissues to produce its own androgens to replace what's lost. And that's where CYP17, these cytochromes go up, and the whole lyase is developed. And in essence, the bone becomes an organ for production of male hormone.
So, but again, androgens, they are stimulating what exactly? The stroma of the bone or the osteoblasts?
Osteoblasts do it specifically, and other stromal elements do it as well. And the cancer cells itself. So what you have is depo production of steroids, testosterone being one. In both compartments, the prostate cancer and in the host compartment. And then that supports in an androgen-dependent fashion the continued growth of prostate cancer in bone.
And I guess that leads into potential interventions, and maybe this paper on MDV-3100, maybe you can explain what it is, what abiraterone is, and how that ties in.
So now, if you castrate, block the androgen receptor with MDV, or block testosterone production with abiraterone, the net effect is all of them will drop their PSA. So if you look at the level of PSA, they will look like they're equivalent drugs. But if you look at the level of how they block it in tissues, what happens is the increase, the amplified and altered androgen receptor, which exists in cancer cells, is blocked by MDV. And if you block the androgen receptor by MDV, our hypothesis is, if we're able to effectively block it, testosterone should rise in the microenvironment, just as an endocrinologist would think the feedback mechanism to protect against block of the androgen receptor.
But when you say MDV blocks the androgen receptor, is that directly or indirectly through a metabolic effect?
Very directly. So MDV-3100 directly blocks the androgen receptor by targeting the androgen receptor.
So that sounds a lot different than abiraterone.
Exactly opposite and complementary is the point.
Huh.
So if you examine it at the level of the PSA concentrations, they look equal. But if you examine it at the level of the tumor, by blocking the androgen receptor, and were you an endocrinologist, you would say, I expect testosterone to rise in a feedback mechanism to protect. And that's exactly what we noted. And if you block production of testosterone in the tissue by blocking CYP17 lyase, which is what abiraterone does, testosterone should be depleted, which we previously showed, and androgen receptor should go up. Obviously, this leads to the rationale of optimizing the depletion of testosterone in the tissue by adding MDV-3100 to abiraterone to maximally deplete in tissue the consequences. Because if you think of this as an adaptive system, as an endocrinologist would, You block CYP17 with abiraterone, you expect the androgen receptor to rise. If you think in terms of the androgen receptor, you block the androgen receptor and CYP17 would rise in response. The typical feedback that an endocrinologist would predict. If you block both of them, you should avoid the escape mechanisms, is the point.
So I think you have to use corticosteroids with abiraterone, and I assume you did with MDV-3100 or not?
No, you don't. Because the corticosteroids are given to block the pituitary response in order to avoid the potassium depletion. So in essence, what you have is at the level of response rate, some similarity. There's no formal comparative trial between the two agents. At the level of biology, there are two dimensions that drive castrate-resistant disease in bone. There's that driven by a uniquely enabled androgen receptor that can take the remaining steroids and use them to the advantage of the cancer that's blocked by MDV-3100, or altered metabolome, steroid metabolome in the bone marrow, which produces androgens in a paracrine fashion. And if you could imagine blocking both of these, you could argue for a more complete depletion of testosterone in the tissues. You need to think of it more along the lines of a super bicalutamide. It's a small molecule blocker of the AR.
All right. Well, I guess we'll step off from this departure back into clinical realities and talk a little bit about taking care of patients. And maybe we can start with your 74-year-old man that, to me, really introduces a question that a lot of oncologists have, which is, where does Sipuleucel-T fit in, if at all?
Yeah. So Sipuleucel-T is one of these unique drugs in the sense you give it, does not achieve objective regression, yet impact survival. And that, I think, has caused a lot of discomfort with people because you like within an individual patient to give a drug, see an impact, and attribute it directly to that. So it's this odd feeling of merely giving it allows you to declare victory, which is discomforting for most. The second thing is that all the data would suggest that with immunotherapies, the earlier you give it, the better. The tumor volume and the tumor volume associated determinants of immune competence are important determinants of benefit. And the third thing which drives when we use this is that if you give the drug too late and you're compelled to give chemotherapy, there's at least a theoretical argument that you could immunosuppress and modify or reduce the benefit from Sipuleucel-T. Those three things together has made it so we tend to give it in patients who have a relatively slowly progressing disease. After the disease has clearly identified itself as progressing and able to spread, but before you feel a sense of urgency to give something like chemotherapy with a significant lag time to introduce Sipuleucel-T. So in many ways, this patient is emblematic of that subset of patients.
And just to clarify, you're talking about in metastatic disease.
In metastatic disease, that's correct.
Before you get into this patient and sort of how it fits in clinically, could you just say a word about your vision about exactly how this agent works? And I know it is being studied in earlier stage disease, what your speculations are in terms of what's going to be seen.
So this is purported to be a typical vaccine and inoculating the patient against, you know, it's a therapeutic vaccine against very specific antigens, PSMA, that are on the surface of the tumor cell. And Ian, you see the same thing with the other vaccines that are going there. But nobody has been able to associate a specific immune effect induction with the outcome. Now, one logical conclusion with that is if you look in the blood and the business end of the disease and the immune response is in tissue, well, of course you won't find it because it's the immune response in tissue, not that which is circulating in the blood, which should be a determinant. So one simple argument that could account for the lack of data to support the hypothesis is you're looking in the blood, not in the tissue, and the response is not going to be seen in blood. The other one is that the hypothesis is wrong. that this is clearly working. The randomized trials show it that way, and yet the hypothesis is wrong. It's either targeting the microenvironment, some determinant, like it's an angiogenesis inhibitor, or it's acting, as some people like Chuck Drake have suggested, through a humoral immune response, the B cell, rather than a primary T cell response, as you would expect from a traditional vaccine. I think it's fair to say that this is conceptually revolutionary, the first vaccine that has impacted survival in a common adult solid tumor, and troublesome that we were unable to predict it and still don't know quite how it's working. And elucidating this is going to have to be critical if we're going to develop rational immunocombinations. And I think this is one of the first with ipilimumab in melanoma, of course, and some hints in prostate cancer, which has brought immunotherapy out of the fringe and into the mainstream, and it forces us to understand this. We frankly have not had an investment in understanding this proportional to that used for chemotherapy and molecular targeted therapies. That has to happen and is happening.
Well, the other thing, and we hear this with the ipilimumab and melanoma, is the idea of looking at different endpoints when you're using immunologic therapy. I mean, the melanoma people, and I guess everybody else, seems convinced there's a subset of patients who really have marked benefit, although they can't really show any immediate response. And so, you know, I guess I sort of think about it as, well, it's just too delayed to be able to see it in a short-term study. Is that the way you visualize SIP? That, I mean, it's actually slowing the disease down, but you just can't see it right away?
So the pragmatic expression of that is the discomfort that we can't find the patient in whom we're going to benefit. And the constant here is that there's an unlinking between the impact on survival and the traditional criteria of response. I think we're agreeing on that.
Or progression-free survival.
Or progression-free survival. So these are sort of these deceleration therapies, if you will, in the sense that we sort of tame the disease, we modify its virulence in some way that we don't fully understand. Compelling but extraordinarily uncomfortable concept when you're trying to be sure you're doing the right thing on an individual patient. And I think limits this field because we don't have a way of measuring this favorable event that impacts survival that is something other than cytoreduction and something other than anti-metastatic. And it could be something as simple as targeting features of the cancer, such as release of cytokines that shorten your survival that we don't think of, that may make you very ill. I mean, it could be affecting it in ways completely different than you and I are talking about now.
I'm just going to say this because I think that a lot of people or oncologists might have it go through their mind. What about the explanation that there is no effect and it's something about the design of the trial, the execution, random chance, something like that?
Yeah. So when we don't have mechanism and all these aligned, that's always what wakes us up at night. And this, of course, was controversial in the FDA, appropriately so, because of that and because of the small initial trials. And I think until we can assign mechanism that we can measure in patients, that crypto fear that there is something in the trial design that we don't understand that accounts for this will always haunt us. We've looked close. Others have looked close. We can't find it. And at some point, you have to say, serial randomized trials with multiple vaccines in prostate cancer showing the same thing. The obligation now is on us to find why it's not right rather than the other way around is how I've evolved. But that discomfort persists, I must confess.
Well, I guess, too, the issue is it is a relatively safe, well-tolerated drug, which kind of makes it a little bit easier to accept, I think.
Correct.
So let's get into the practical issue. Maybe you can just kind of present this patient in terms of what happened and what is happening with the patient, and maybe just go through the case first.
This is a 74-year-old male with a 7-year past history of prostate cancer who had initial diagnosis of localized high-grade disease with low stage, Gleason score 8 and T2B, and who was treated with surgery. He had focally positive disease extending to the margin and was treated with radiation therapy. Despite that, he had a rising PSA noted at 8 months following completion of the radiation therapy, and on 4 years of continuous and sustained androgen ablation, which he received actually at another institution before he came to us, the patient experienced a further rise in PSA concentration to 27, and the bone scan revealed the lesions, bone lesions at the thoracic spine and iliac bone, completely asymptomatic and no other comorbid conditions. We were confronted with the dilemma. He was anxious, and we thought that this was the appropriate interval to give him Sapulis LT.
Just out of curiosity, was he an educated person trying to read about all this or really just kind of leaving it up to you?
He came here driven principally by the need to do something and was both versed in Sapulis LT and chemotherapy. His physician had actually asked him to consider chemotherapy in this setting, and in the absence of metastases, we dissuaded him from chemotherapy. We thought, so you drop the PSA and it rises and you add to morbidity. We feel in this setting chemotherapy is not the right choice. He had, when he came in, a single T-spine and a single iliac bone lesion when he presented at the time of castrate resistance with the PSA 27.
I mean, how long ago was this at that point when you offered the Sapulis LT?
About a year and a half ago.
What about the use of chemotherapy in this situation where the patient has pretty minimal metastatic disease and is asymptomatic? You know, for example, if he wasn't eligible for or didn't want to receive SIP-T.
Yeah. So our view that I think has evolved to the prevailing view and is different than 5 years ago and 7 years ago is that since chemotherapy is effective within a reasonable range of the disease, principal benefit is to relieve symptoms and has a modest effect on survival, one would wait till symptoms are either imminent or very early before introducing chemotherapy. And the community has evolved to sort of delaying the initiation of chemotherapy till then, because basically you result in a suppression of the PSA, you stop the therapy and it rises, and you wonder how you benefited the patient.
Just out of curiosity, did you start him on bone-targeted therapy at that point?
He actually came with bisphosphonates given continuously, and we continued them.
Given during the time he was getting the androgen deprivation?
What time he was getting the androgen deprivation.
Interesting. So how did he do in the Sapulis LT? How did that go?
Well, he tolerated it well, and then he had a rise in his PSA concentration, which was the expected outcome. Fortunately, it came 5 months after approaching that window of delay that we'd like to delay before we do anything else in case there's a negative interaction between the two interventions, chemotherapy and the like. His bone scan was stable and his PSA was rising, so we delayed for almost 2 months longer than that, and he developed a new bone lesion after that. And he got placed on a chemotherapy trial that incorporated docetaxel and dasatinib, the SRC inhibitor.
As long as you're mentioning dasatinib, what do we know about that in prostate cancer?
Strong data to implicate SRC signaling in prostate cancer progression in bone. Strong data to indicate that we can effectively suppress the osteoclast in the context of bone metastases in patients with prostate cancer with dasatinib. And the randomized trial of docetaxel plus dasatinib is completed, randomized placebo-controlled trial, and we hope to be able to give you the results of that trial in about 3-4 months.
Interesting. And I guess it's placebo-controlled, so you don't know what he got?
He does not know what he got.
What do you see? I actually just did a program with your CML colleague, Susan O'Brien, so dasatinib is kind of heavily on my mind. What's been seen in prostate cancer, you know, the pleural effusions, or what do you see?
It's very interesting. We're so struck by, and it's a paper that will be soon be published, by the absence of synergistic side effects, which you'd argue for with docetaxel and dasatinib, that you would have had pleural effusions as a rate-limiting effect. It just hasn't materialized. We speculate that the reason for that is that the low dose of prednisone that we use in combination with this mitigates the effect of dasatinib on causing a pleural effusion. Steroids seem to mitigate, as Susan O'Brien will tell you, in patients with CML, dasatinib's ability to retain fluid. So we think that that modification is a steroid-mediated modification, but don't have the direct experiment to show that.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I do recall her talking about steroids being used when the patients develop pleural effusion. How did he do, I guess, mainly in terms of the docetaxel?
Well, his PSA has dropped, and he's tolerating it well. He's actually on his 9th cycle of therapy. So he's had a very favorable response.
So I have to ask you about the new TKI, XL184, cabozantinib, and the new data that were just reported at ASCO on that agent.
So XL184 is, of course, a c-MET and VEGFR2 inhibitor. It has one of the most striking changes in bone scan that happens immediately in this that is linked to a reduction in bone pain. And those patients who have an improvement, these striking improvements in bone scan and reduction in bone pain, seem in an uncontrolled study to be the subset whose disease is controlled longest and best on XL184. There are some patients, as was reported and as we've seen with XL184, who have regression of soft tissue metastases as well. So it's clear that XL184 is not exclusively a drug that alters images of bone scans. It causes favorable events in the cancer. But precisely because of this immediate and striking change in the bone scan, precisely if the bone scan's changes are proportional to the antitumoral activity is unclear. So it may be that we're blocking c-MET in the osteoblast. c-MET is increased in expression in the osteoblast adjacent to the tumor, and this is having anti-tumor activity, which unquestionably, in my mind, exists with XL184, and an effect on the bone scan, both independent and parallel to this efficacy. I don't think all the changes can be attributed to just changes in the bone scan. These patients benefit too much for too long, and there's soft tissue regression.
Well, the thing that, is striking, I was thinking about what you were saying about bone, that we've seen people with metastatic bone disease, whether it's, breast cancer or, I guess myeloma or whatever, have responses clinically. I mean, maybe they're not as striking as with XL184, but certainly people have pain go away. But it's hard to kind of think about hearing about bone scans getting better.
This is a very striking feature of this disease that has got everybody sitting up in their chair looking and trying to figure it out. We're obviously all rushing, both in experimental systems and in humans, by biopsying bones to try to understand this.
Why don't we go on to your 78-year-old man, and again, if you could kind of present him.
Okay. So this is a 78-year-old male with prostate cancer, bone metastases, and a rising PSA to 183 with symptomatic progression, which was bone pain. Bone revealed multiple areas of involvement in multiple sites, skull, T-spine, L-spine, rib, and pelvis. And he received docetaxel at 3-week intervals, 70 per meter squared. Feels better after one course. PSA dropped to 112 following course 3 and to 67 after course 4, but he had an initial rise in his PSA concentration. This patient was interesting to me because he was actually sent to me by his physician after the first course of therapy as having progressed because of the rising PSA concentration despite the symptomatic improvement. And I just wanted to emphasize that if you look at the docetaxel experiments reported both by Tanik and by Dan Petrelak in the initial approval, there was, in almost a third of patients, a transient rise in PSA concentration. So this thing is to emphasize that, one, in this patient with progressive disease and despite his age, chemotherapy is the right thing to do. It palliates immediately. And in the context of symptomatic improvement, PSA concentration in the first 2 cycles of therapy does not constitute failure.
Any hypotheses about why the PSA goes up? Does it correlate with response? Is it like a flare reaction?
Yeah. So I think flare reaction is fair. Labeling it as a flare is fair, but the underlying mechanism is unclear. The sort of glib statement that we make, it's tumor necrosis, rising PSA and the like, I think there's little evidence to that, but it's clear that it rises transiently.
Any global comments on what you see as the sensitivity or lack of sensitivity to chemo in general in prostate cancer?
So, too, I do think it's a chemotherapy-sensitive disease. And the paradox is when you give the chemotherapy earlier in the evolution of the disease, pre-prostatectomy and the like, you don't see the analogous striking regression of disease that you see in colon or in bladder or in breast cancer. So there's a relationship between early and late disease in prostate cancer that is more analogous to CML, where the BCR-ABL-driven component is completely different than the blast crisis, and the blast crisis equivalent in prostate cancer is responsive to chemotherapy, and the evidence for a beneficial effect of chemotherapy early in the disease is absent.
I think there's maybe been a perception, particularly because it took a while to kind of get the chemotherapy data out, that maybe it wasn't sensitive. And maybe part of that was, you know, so much of the issue of measurement of bone disease in some of these trials.
So I agree with that completely. When I first started in this, I remember when we were doing chemotherapy trials, I used to get questions from the audience, and what is your motive for punishing these old men? And I think that's a sentiment that he's trying to squash, which I agree with completely. These patients benefit and tolerate chemotherapy in the hands of a reasonably skilled oncologist.
And, you know, overall, what do you say to symptomatic patients like this one in terms of the chance that they're going to actually feel better?
So I tell them that more than half, somewhere around 60%, benefit. And in half of those, again, 30% of the total, the benefit is so striking that it's a sustained response that can last for more than 8 months or a year. But a third of them get transient responses. So what we need to do is give two doses of chemotherapy and make a judgment based on how much they've improved and how well they've tolerated, how much we persist, or whether we switch to something else.
What do you see as the likely course of events for this man over the next year, and what kind of treatment do you think is in his future?
Well, again, this illustrates the challenge that faces us, and that is how to create a logical sequence of therapies so patients can drift from abiraterone to chemotherapy to bone-targeted therapies at a logical sequence or some different sequence or combination that'll work best. So unfortunately, his survival with this is less than 3 years and probably closer to two. That with effective and logical application of therapy, chemotherapy to its maximum response, and sort of be a thoughtful purveyor of focal radiation therapy to try to avoid symptoms and cord compression, you should be able to limit the duration of time in his survival where he has severe pain and avoid cord compression or big fractures by being attentive to the metastatic lesions. I see marrow failure in his future, and I see sort of progressive weakness and modest bone pain, and I see that in about 3 years.
What do you think his next therapy is likely to be?
Well, he's in our institution where we have a lot of molecular targeted therapies and we're exploring bone biology. We will explore and are exploring abiraterone in combination with dasatinib right now. He would be considered for that. We are exploring the combination of abiraterone with sunitinib, both drugs that possess individual antitumor activity. We're looking at the FGF inhibitors, and we're looking at novel inhibitors of alternate androgen biosynthesis in the marrow to try to block any depleted androgens that may exist.
What about outside a protocol setting? You know, one of the agents that theoretically would be a consideration in his future would be cabazitaxel. What do you think about that agent and how do you utilize it?
Yes, cabazitaxel, samarium, you know, until the alpha emitters get approved is a reasonable thing to consider. And surprisingly, oral cyclophosphamide, I think, is still an old standard with low doses of vincristine. You know, the CVD regimens, cyclophosphamide, vincristine, dexamethasone, were reported by the Mayo Clinic. And these are, you know, critical investigators who looked at this and found benefits rate in the 40% rate, and that sort of impresses us as being well. Yes, cabazitaxel clearly works in a subset of patients. In heavily pretreated patients, we sometimes start at a lower dose than the recommended dose. Instead of 25 and 20, we'll occasionally start even at 15 to make sure they tolerate it. But there are a subset of patients who are docetaxel refractory that clearly benefit from cabazitaxel.
So one of the things that I guess we're looking forward to that oncologists ask, you know, they hear about cabazitaxel and say, well, why wouldn't we want to use it before docetaxel? And of course, I think those two agents are being looked at head to head. How would you, from what you can see at this point, compare what might be seen in terms of toxicity of those two agents as well as efficacy?
Less neurotoxicity, but slightly more myelosuppression with carbazitaxel. I think the first wave of toxicity is the typical thing that happens with a new agent. I mean, you've been at this challenge for a while, as well as I have, and the first wave always seems to have heightened concerns about toxicity, and then we learn how to manage them. There are probably patients who tolerate docetaxel better and others that tolerate carbazitaxel better, and experience will allow us to use them. Relative efficacy is hard to judge. I think they're very different drugs in contrary to how I initially felt. And there's some evidence to suggest that microtubules are implicated in androgen signaling, and carbazitaxel is much more effective in blocking microtubular-supported androgen signaling.
Always coming back to androgen and bones, huh?
Correct. I mean, it's microtubular seems to drive this. So all those things are together. Frankly, we seem to be trapped in single-agent chemotherapies in prostate cancer. And the study that will be initiated at our place soon, because I think the data is compelling that carboplatinum works well, is carbazitaxel with or without carboplatinum to try to improve the response rate. So we'd like to go beyond comparing single-agent docetaxel to single-agent carbazitaxel, but to try to make either of them or both of them even better in combination.
Maybe you can comment on this 64-year-old man who interestingly received carbo along with docetaxel. I don't know if it was on that study or not, but what's the thinking in terms of platinums in prostate cancer and specifically with taxanes?
So I'm going to give you a thumbnail sketch of that patient and why I selected him. And he did get the carboplatin in the context of a clinical trial. So he's a 64-year-old male who initially presents with regionally advanced high-grade disease and literally progresses through initial local therapy and progresses through hormonal therapy with a very short interval, and then has progressive disease despite castration with a low PSA concentration. PSA rose to 3.2 after initial decline to 0.5 and had asymptomatic large recurrence in his primary. This was biopsied to exclude the presence of small cell cancer, which is we always suspect when there's rapid growth and no significant rise in PSA, and we only find an adenocarcinoma.
Small cell of the prostate.
Small cell of the prostate. So one of our investigators feels like despite the morphologic heterogeneity, adenocarcinomas as opposed to small cell carcinomas, these patients and these tumors have shared clinical features. Visceral metastases more frequent, instead of bone-forming metastases, lytic metastases, and a relatively low PSA concentration with a short duration of response to hormonal therapy. This subset appears to us to be platinum responsive, and in the end stage or the advanced stage of the disease may be represented in up to one-third of the patients with lethal prostate cancer. There's data from the group at the Farber and ourselves in phase two trials, not randomized trial, that carboplatin, even in the absence of small cell carcinoma, increases the response rate and the durability of the response. Based on that data, a randomized trial is ongoing.
And I see here that you were part of, I guess, a paper that was just reported at ASCO, a poster that kind of got into this issue of carbo and docetaxel. Can you talk about specifically, I guess this is what you were referring to before, what you all looked at and reported there?
Yes. These were a group of patients that were prospectively, I think it was 112 patients, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I was surprised that you could find so many.
Well, they're much more frequent. It's one of those things you don't notice them until you look. And these are a group of patients who had the following features: large pelvic mass, small cell carcinoma, and that was the minority, or a very transient response to hormonal therapy, or visceral involvement, or lytic bone metastases as opposed to blastic. And in these patients, which we found these many, had a response rate that was higher than was anticipated using the SWOG algorithm, the predicted response and duration of response with docetaxel alone for this subset, and it was very well tolerated. These patients, there was a high rate, even though the initial biopsies were negative, of both developing brain metastasis in the subset, a phenomenon not common in prostate cancer, and eventually detecting some elements of small cell carcinoma. So we feel that this data validates our initial hypothesis that this subset is a variant of lethal prostate cancer that is common, is platinum sensitive, and it forms the basis of this randomized trial that we're looking at.
Now, the title of the poster begins characterization of the anaplastic prostate carcinoma. So anaplastic versus small cell?
Yeah, so anaplastic is an unfortunate term that we keep stumbling on because we don't think that this tumor is only small cell carcinomas. There's sampling issues with trying to depend on small cell. We see patients that we look at don't have much PSA or any PSA at all, hepatic metastases, lytic bone. We biopsy them and we only find adeno. Yet they look and they behave like small cell carcinomas. Anybody who takes care of prostate cancer see these. They don't respond well to abiraterone in our experience to date, and they seem to respond better to carboplatinum-based. They have a high molecular profile, and they ultimately develop a high rate of brain metastases and small cell carcinoma at some point in time.
So would it be too sort of out there to think about PARP inhibitors in those patients?
Absolutely. BRCA1-ishness or BRCA2-ishness is one of the things that we're thinking of and is a pathway that may be implicated here. There are other pathways that are looked at specifically as well in this subset. So this is clearly a subset of patients who have an aggressive variant of prostate cancer that appears to be platinum sensitive and doesn't behave as would be expected. And as we're treating this disease more aggressively, we think is represented in the lethal form of this disease as much as high as 1 in 3 of the total group.
So are there actual thoughts about trying PARP inhibitors?
Yes.
With the platinums?
Well, we're doing the single agent followed by the combination just to make sure we know what we're doing.
So you're actually doing it?
We have it proposed. We don't have it going. It's been submitted.